You are listening to the Mick and Mac GAA Football Podcast. Okay, so Stephen Poacher joined us today for a great chat. We talked all about his coaching philosophy, his tactical approaches, and we touched on, of course, the Carlow Rising, and also the news that came out yesterday that Tyrannic O'Brien has resigned as the Carlow Senior Football Manager. We just want to apologise in advance that some parts of the recording is a little bit buffery just because of the internet connection. But otherwise, guys, it was really, really good chat, and we hope you enjoy it. Thanks a lot.
Let's just say.
Probably a little bit one-sided.
A hand in there for Michael Derma, but it's gone to John Murphy. Look who's coming forward, Horst Lawler. He can wrap it up into the moor. Horst goes for the shot. It's a...
Okay, hello and welcome back to the Mick and Mac GA Football Podcast. Mac, how's things?
All good, my friend, as usual. I can't complain. Enjoying the good weather, thank God.
No hangovers this weekend?
Fresh as a daisy, thank God. Big, big change, my man. She was clapping down on me this weekend.
You're dead right. Delighted to be joined by Stephen Poacher. Stevie, how are you getting on?
Not too bad, lads. Pleasure to be on. Pleasure to be on, guys.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I suppose, Steve, a couple of pieces of news over the weekend. The GAA have set out the roadmap for playing. So we're looking at club football coming back at the end of July and county probably in October. What's your thoughts on that?
Listen, lads, for someone whose life is completely engrossed in GAA through club and school and county, there's no one would love to see it back more than myself. I think it'll be absolutely brilliant. Not even lads from a physical perspective for the young lads, but we've come across a lot of our young lads, particularly in the county minors, and I'm managing Bryant for the seniors actually this year and down, and I've come across a lot of lads who, over the last number of months, have probably been struggling a little bit, you know, mentally as much as physically, just massive jolt to people's systems, you know, when they're not used to it, and it was a great release for people, so... I think it's huge, lads. But then on the flip side of it, I don't want to be a doom merchant here, but you know, we need to probably proceed with caution too, because got a couple of lads today out in the golf course actually, and Ali Holland clubmen, committee men and staunch clubmen, and we were just sort of saying, like, God forbid, touch wood, if the football started again and you know, a prominent elderly member of the community passed away, God forbid, with COVID, you know, what way does that leave the community? What way does that leave the club? What way does that leave the fixtures, you know? So We're probably lads in uncharted territory. Well, we are in uncharted territory and we're very much in the unknown. So, listen, I think the GAA have acted fantastically well in this from day one. In fact, they were probably one of the main reasons why our sales in the north haven't gone the same direction as Boris's brigade across the water, you know. So, because, you know, the leadership I think that they showed very early in this was tremendous, man. You know, particularly... It's funny because in school, I'm in St. Joseph's in Newry, and the young lads were devastated because we had two teams actually that had qualified out of their group and were both in under 15 Ulster semi final and under 13 Ulster semi final. And our under 13s probably would have won it comfortably. And I think the 15s would have been there or thereabouts. And I felt sorry for those young lads, and I felt sorry for the young lads at St. Coleman's as well, who were in a McCrory final. And, you know, it's a big thing for young lads, and then all of a sudden it's just pulled, and, you know, they miss out on it. Like, and senior players probably can handle those disappointments a bit more. But, listen, it's positive, lads. It's positive. There's a lot of thoughts going in it, but it's going to be a lot of work too for clubs to sort of police it. And you're sort of thinking to yourself, is it realistic that you can actually police that level of detail? You know, probably not.
You just touched on there, obviously being up the north. Is it harder for people, maybe GA clubs up the north, to deal with it when they see, obviously, what Boris is doing across the water and what the Republic are doing? Like, it's obviously a different approach. Is it kind of frustrating for maybe GA clubs in the north to deal with it?
Yeah, but better be careful. I better be very careful here. Don't mention the word UK. After Big Sean got himself in trouble. But no, the fact of the matter is, look, we are in the north of Ireland. And, you know, for me, I think it was absolutely nonsensical, lads, at the very start of this, not to have a one-island approach. And, you know, I'm not a political person. To be honest with you, I lost all respect for politics a long time ago. But I'm not a political person, but I think... us up here, we're the only bloody country in the world that we're trying to argue over whether the virus was green or blue at one stage. But no, but the funny thing is, and this is the thing, I think the GAA got back to that, has been instrumental in actually guiding a lot of people in the north, because the GAA is community based. You know, we're obviously, you know, every community in the north here obviously has some sort of attachment in a nationalist perspective to the GAA. And I think that things slowed down here a lot quicker than they did in England and Wales and Scotland. And I think then after a while, you know, the Northern Ireland government obviously realised, I think we need to sail our own ship here, you know. But lads, it's important to remember, and it is worth noting, England's very unique. I lived in England for 4 years. I lived in Manchester. England doesn't have the same sort of, you know, community-based atmosphere that we would have, and, you know, knowing your neighbours. Like, I have friends in London and Manchester still who tell me they've lived in a place for 8 years and haven't spoken to a single neighbour. Do you know what I mean? Mad stuff like that. Whereas, like, we have a WhatsApp group here in the street. There's 30 houses in a WhatsApp group, everybody in it. And, you know, just wee things like that. You know, we had those community values. We always had them in Ireland, you know, and I think that has been vitally important. And we probably haven't had the huge central urban areas that they have in the likes of Manchester, Birmingham, London, stuff like that, you know. But I go back to the GAA again. I do feel that they played a big role in this, lads, you know.
So we start off with the kind of club and bits and pieces, Steve. We know you probably, with all the coaching background you have, so you obviously played a good bit yourself.
Played. Oh, listen, we were laughing today, actually. I obviously didn't have an illustrious playing career. You know, it's very, very easy to go into a change rooms at 37, 38 years of age when you're coming in with maybe a bag of Ulster medals or All-Ireland medals as a player, and you know, your reputation is more or less intact before you even open your mouth, you know. So I probably had to earn my stripes a bit quicker and a bit harder probably than some of the past players who've been very successful. Now, you know, for me, I've always made this point, just because you were a really successful player doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be a really successful manager. For me, like, you know, some of my heroes were immortal in playing terms, but in GAA that is, but some of them not necessarily worked out as really good managers. But I suppose things were very easy for me, lads, from a coaching point of view, and the fact that, you know, I teach, so you're doing it every day. But come back to my playing. Listen, I played my club football for Newry Mitchells here in Newry. And I moved from Mitchells to Castle Island in 2004. We built a house out there, and we moved out for a couple of seasons, and then obviously went back to Mitchells again. But I'll be totally honest, lads, I wasn't really enjoying my football. I was in my late 20s, I think 29, I think it was, and we were playing junior level at the time. Numbers were low at training. And I had actually just come off the back of winning an All-Ireland vocational schools, managing the team in St. Clubman's, smallest school ever to win an All-Ireland, an A All-Ireland title. And I got an unbelievable buzz off that, you know, from a coaching perspective. And the following year, Damien Barton from Derry was managing Burnham Down. And he says, look, when you come in and train the team once a week, or coach them once a week. And I was still playing at 29, you know, didn't have the illustrious playing career that a lot of guys had. And you were going to do a change room with, you know, real established county players, you know, the likes of Sean Ward and Daniel McCartan and Owen McCartan, and even wee James was still floating about at the time in his later years. And obviously you had young boys coming through like Kevin McCurran and stuff like that. But it actually nearly really grew me, lads, and grew me as a coach very, very quickly. It gave me the confidence then, obviously, then to push on. And the following year, Martin Clark's club and Rift approached me and asked me to manage them. So I became a very, very young manager at 30. So I've probably had a better experience coaching, probably had a head start on most people, if you understand what I'm saying, because a lot of people played to their mid-30s, whereas I only played till I was 29, 30, you know, and the decision was sort of made for me that I wasn't really enjoying it. I was crippled with bloody chronic hamstring problems and stuff like that as well, and the coaching was something that I was getting more joy out of, lads, if I'm going to be completely honest, you know.
Yeah, and when you were playing, Stevie, like when you were on the pitch or like in game time, whatever, were you like, oh, I'd actually rather just be coaching here than actually trying to get up the field or kick points? Or, like, did you obviously enjoyed coaching far more?
The strange one, because I actually started coaching at 19. I'll tell you what actually happened. We actually had I was actually at Manchester University, and I set up the Gaelic club in Manchester. Manchester Metropolitan Crew and Osage, and we set up a Gaelic club. We had some brilliant footballers, but it was a sort of a social thing, and then we sort of started to get a bit more serious, and I went to one of the wee local pubs who no one was in. Like, it was funny, like, there was nobody would have went to this wee pub called the Mayor Inn, and we went to it one night, and we just said, look, if you sponsor a set of jerseys for us, the guy Dave, a couple of games in the year. I don't know who had second in the series, but a long time ago, man. But we went in anyway, and he said, if you sponsor a set of jerseys for us, we'll drink in here every Sunday after games and things like that, you know? So, you know yourself, student, like, it's absolutely cool. And actually, boys, and this is no word of a lie, when I left college after those 3 or 4 years in Manchester, that bar was actually the most popular student bar at the weekends, because we just created it. We left a legacy behind us. You know, of course, when the jerseys came in, they had to be red and black, like, with much to the dismay of the Brown and the Armagh Brigade, you know. But listen, we had some great days. We were a kick of the ball away, lads, from heading back to Ireland to the Trench Cup, you know. And I managed the team. I trained the team. I played the team. I was the treasurer. I was the secretary. I was the chairman. And it ultimately actually awarded me with the university, gave me the ultimate compliment when I was leaving. I was awarded with the beautiful tie, and those were treasured things for a soccer player or a hockey player or a rugby player in England, but it was unheard of for Gaelic games. So I suppose that was the start of the coaching journey, lads, you know, at a very young age over in college, and you got the bug for it. You always probably had that from teaching, lads, you always probably had that coaching head on you, you know, that you were thinking about the game. Probably I probably thought about the game a lot more than some of the players did. Like, I remember suggesting you know, playing a corner forward and bringing him out, and lads looking at you going, you know, you're mad in my head, you know. And this was like, you know, obviously in late 90s, early 2000s, you know, when it was unheard of.
What would your philosophies be as a coach, Stevie? Like, what do you stand by?
Well, Michael, listen, I've been asked this question quite a few times about philosophies, and it's important that you don't get mistaken between philosophy and system and style. You know, philosophy is very unique to you. It's very unique to every individual coach. Every coach should have a philosophy. It took me a long time to come up with a coaching philosophy. I have wrote it down. It's in black and white. I don't, you know, think that it's going to be there in stone. I think it'll change as I evolve, you know, as I grow. But the same core principles still remain, Mike. And I suppose one of my philosophies is that, you know, it's obviously to create a spirit and a togetherness within a group that I'm working in. And that's something that I take great pride on, whether it be school, club or county. We've always created a great togetherness, a great spirit, a great cohesion. I think that's so important in a group, that those dynamics are right. On top of that, you want to obviously facilitate a really good, high energetic coaching training environment where players will obviously, you're obviously striving to help players reach their potential while also obviously letting them have fun. And I think the final thing of my philosophy, the 3-point goal, would be that the start of the team is the team. You know, no individual is greater than the cause. And that's something that I would pride myself on, lads. It's something that I feel very strongly about, that, you know, and guys that have worked with me and players that have worked with me know that, you know, and you value your players and people rather than as players, lads. And, you know, I'm a real players man. I like to get to know the players. I like to get to know their backgrounds. I like to get to know their families. I like to get to know things about them, because when you show players that you care, then, you know, obviously they're going to respond a bit better to that. You know, I think it's the same as school as well. You know, gone are the days of I'm the teacher, you're the pupil, don't speak to me. You've got some young lad, some introvert in your class, who's really good at the guitar, and you just go to that young fella and say, how are you getting on with your guitar lessons? Yeah. He look at you and maybe think, he knows how to play the guitar, and all of a sudden he might become that little introvert shy boy. All of a sudden it could have made his day, could have made his week, could have made his month. You know, and sometimes we dismiss that in teaching. You know, that real little small little detail, you know, getting to know the pupil as a person rather than just a pupil, you know, a number in front of you, you know.
And you mentioned team spirit there. So how do you build a team spirit within a squad?
Well, it can be difficult. It can be difficult, you know. I've probably been fortunate that I've had some great groups. You know, obviously, Enrique was very, very, I wouldn't say it was easy because it was my first managing job, but I had taught 50% of the squad, you know, for 5 years in Kilkeel. So when you taught a lot of lads, you know a lot about them, and you know what buttons to press and what buttons not to press. But I suppose lads is one thing. I'm a big believer in having a bit of camaraderie, a bit of cracker training. I think it's vitally important. I don't rule authoritarian style. You know, we try and create a democracy. You know, you want to identify leadership within the group. You want to try and set up some leadership groups, getting lads to socialize, lads. The social aspect of your club is so important, and it has become such a bloody contentious issue with drink bans and nonsense and boys getting put off panels and don't speak to the media and don't do this, don't do that. And I remember a couple of years ago seeing a great photograph of Big Quigley from Fermanagh sitting with a pizza box, and he says, you know, 6 pints and a pizza or something like that. And, you know, like, you need that bit of character, because he's sitting there, he's probably thinking to himself, well, like, I'm not going to win a fucking All-Ireland, you know, so I'm going to enjoy myself. And you know something, there's a lot to be said for, and I always laugh and joke, a team that drinks together stays together. But I was a big believer, lads, at senior level in creating and harnessing that group. You know, social days, lads, days away, you know, team bonding exercises, little things, like small little things. I'll give you an example. So we came to Valley Home at the very start. Some of the younger lads would have come into the changing room with their bags, sat in the corner, left the changing room straight home. So then I said, no, right, you know, you can't bait someone into the shower, but you're sort of encouraging lads, get sorted and changed here, lads, with everybody, and we'll all go into the club after. Yeah. And the club put on tea, sandwiches, chicken goujons. We didn't have to go in and drink. We didn't have to go in and get leathered, you know. So, but what tended to happen at the time, the Friday is the biggest night of the week then, because you play your league games on a Friday night, and then the lads would all go into the club. Everybody would be together, 4 or 5 pints, and there might be a spillover on the Saturday. The young lads might go to discos, whatever, and the older boys might be doing their own thing. But it was great because you had that. In school, it's slightly different. But school, I think, is easier because they're with each other, lads, every day, all day. You know, so you get more contact time with them. You know, you can harness that. In Kilkenny, it was very, very easy because we were a small rural school at the foot of the Mourne Mountains, and it was a fantastic, made a fantastic spirit. You know, we used to harness what we called Mourne spirit, because Mourne was a very unique area of Down with 5 clubs, Glasdrummond, Ballymartin, Longstone, Ballycollin and Raith. So we had that little bit of spirit that other schools maybe didn't have, you know. And I'm trying to currently do the same in Newry here with St. Joseph's. You know, you're trying to say to the young lads, be fucking proud of your school. You know, be proud of where you're from. You're not just representing your school, you're representing the community of Newry. You're representing your clubs, you know, and you just try and create and harness that little bit of spirit. But listen, Michael, it's not easy. It is difficult, and it takes constant reinforcement. This is not something that you just do a team building session and think, oh, we're great, we're all together, we've had a great night. You need to be harnessing it all the time. Small little things. And it could be a simple little thing, and you might laugh at this. You know, one of the nights after training, right, Wednesday night, everybody bring a towel. We're heading down to the tide for a dip in the water after training. Something like that. Something small, yeah. Something simple. But little things to just keep the group together as much as possible.
And so, Steve, so what I'm kind of gathering from you, just kind of keeping it simple and just, like, do you think with coaching, like, a lot of people kind of, overcomplicate it and read lists and look at different formations? Like, do you think there's a lot said about coaching, like?
Well, I seen a tweet the other day, actually. I put up a wee video of one of the scores Carlo got against Kildare or something like that, you know, and I just talked about the middle third being a launch pad for attacks, and you're looking to try and create little mini overloads, and you're obviously looking for width in your attack, then you're looking for an injection of speed, then you're looking for obviously a quality of the finish, like, you know, and someone rode underneath it, like, you always get a troll popping up now and again, but someone rode underneath it, you know, simple game complicated by coaches or something like that. But I think the game is so much better. Like, I was watching these older games, you know, and I think back to the Down Derry game in 1984, which has been described as the greatest game of all time. It's my own county involved, and I was obviously 14 at the time, was it? 14, 15. I wasn't in Celtic Park because there was only a handful of tickets because the ground was packed out. So we didn't get down to Celtic Park, but I remember watching it. And at the time, you were just amazed at the intensity, fierce pace of the game. But when you watch the back a couple of weeks ago on TG Carra, and you looked at the volume of turnovers in the game, you looked at how the ball was just kicked in the direction that it was. It was more or less nearly, lads, a case of, you know, man on man, win your battle. And if we win 9 battles, we'll win the game. And don't get me wrong, you have class, absolutely glorious footballers like Ross Carr, Greg Blaney, Jwee James, Mickey Linden. Boys that could play in this year, of course they could. But I just think the game as a spectacle has become a little bit better. I think teams are tactically more astute. I think the kickouts have become so intriguing now. You've got kickout strategies. You have teams trying to decode each other's kickouts. You know, you have full press. You have zonal presses. You have teams that drop off. You know, if put it against that, if everybody played the same way, I think we would have a very boring game. You know, I just think it's very interesting that some teams might adapt, you know, a full high press. Some teams like to operate a middle third press. Some teams like to operate a more deep line defence. I don't think it's that complicated. I think it's just that sometimes people get scared by lingo. Like, you take the word transition, for example. You know, if Jurgen Klopp or Mourinho or Guardiola mentioned transition, there's not a word about it. But if a Gaelic coach mentions transition, you've got all the dinosaurs firing the book at the TV going, what's he really talking about? no transition in my fucking day, you kick them all in. And that's grand, and that's their opinion. But the reality of the situation is that that's the way the game has gone. You know, that's the line we're going down. And listen, lads, we're under no illusions, despite what the traditionalists and the hurling brigade would tell you. Hurling's the same. Hurling's exactly the same. And you look at how Limerick played through the lines. I know nothing about hurling, but I can watch Limerick playing and the way Paul Kinnock has coached that team and how they play through the lines. And you know how you can actually see their game sense in the game in comparison to other counties that play hurling, more or less just goalkeeper whacks, pucks it out as far as he can. Well. You know what I mean? So yeah. There's a method to their play, and you can actually see that very identifiable, you know.
And say, Stevie, like, and I was watching, there was the 94 Kerry in Dublin game from years ago. Like, do you think we kind of get them times again, whereas it's free falling football and 15v15 man on man, or is it just so hard to watch at the minute at times?
Well, I just think the other thing we have to know is, and we've got to remember, is it's a bit like soccer. And I think back to the glory days. I lived in Manchester from 96 to 99, and or sorry, 96 to 2004 years, and like, you know, Oasis were in their plum. You know, Euro 96 was on in England. United were winning everything. Like, it couldn't have got any better for me, you know. And
we still are.
What's that?
United still are.
Hey, you know, but hey, but the beauty of it was, like, you know, you're watching football back then thinking football's so much better. But the reason we probably think that is because you're waiting for match of the day on a Saturday night to watch the highlights, right? And you got the odd live game midweek, or you get the odd live FA Cup game. But then, you know, Sky TV come along, and then by the time the late 90s, early 2000s come, everyone's got Sky, and you're exposed to a huge volume of games. So you're watching so many more games, so much more football. And it's a wee bit like that in Gaelic. You know, you really only got exposed to Ulster finals, All-Ireland semi-finals, All-Ireland finals. And let's be honest, you know, true finals and semi-finals and All-Ireland finals, the majority of them are well-contested contests, they're good games, or, you know, they're hardy games. But because we're exposed to so many other games now, you know, and because they obviously the gap is so much bigger in certain capacities with the Dublins, the Trones, the Kerrys, the Mayos. But it's the same lads in every single sport. You know, you've got the All Blacks, you've got New Zealand, you've got Australia, you've got South Africa, England. You know, you've got all these rugby nations that are so far ahead. You go to the Rugby World Cup, teams get tonked, but for every tonking, there's a Japan that beats an Ireland, and you're going, whoa, where did that come from? Yeah. And you need those. You know, sport needs that. And soccer's exactly the same. You know, Liverpool are 25 points clear in the Premier League. You know, like, and I would say if they went out tomorrow and played a team from League Two or League Three or League One or League Two, they would win 6 or 7 nil. But they wouldn't be a word about it, you know, because it's a cup competition. And that's where I think we're making the mistake in Gaelic games. The leagues are a fantastic competition. Some of the games I've seen in the National League have been absolutely outstanding. I went to watch Armagh and Clare. Carlo had a free weekend a few years ago, and Down had played on the same night. Carlo had played on the Saturday night, Down had played on the Saturday night. So Armagh were playing Clare, and I went to watch them Sunday. Unbelievable game of football, like something like 2-11 to, you know, 1-14. And you know, I went away from that thinking, that was class. But you know, the Sunday game didn't even mention it, didn't show it. Nobody knew that. Half the people didn't even know it was on. You know, we were watching highlights of a game that we'd watched live on TG Car that day. So I think the problem is that we're not exposed to enough of those better games, those well-matched games. And I think the league should be a brand that we should be pushing, lads, rather than the championship. The championship, everybody deserves their day out. Regardless of what the B pushers say, everybody deserves their day out. Everybody deserves their day in the sun. And funny, I got a phone call from a journalist today, ringing me, asked me about Turlock and what my relationship with him and stuff was. He stepped down at the beginning there. But like, I said to him, like, he has no idea of how proud Turlock O'Brien was as a Carlovian. To see Tyrone come into Dr. Cullen Park, to see Monaghan come into Dr. Cullen Park, to go up against Jim Galvin, for Turlock to go up against Jim Galvin along the lane in Port Leash against Dublin, live on TV, the exposure that it gave the county, the lift that it gave the county. You can beat the drum all you like, but I would never substitute those days, you know, beating Kildare, Tullamore, having Monaghan more or less beaten with 5 minutes to go. You'd never substitute those days for a B championship against, you know, Leighton or Wicklow, whatever, in the middle of nowhere with 300-400 people. I mean, you just wouldn't, lads. You just wouldn't, you know.
Yeah. You touched on Carlo there, Steve. I'm going to move on to that. So, obviously, you come to Carlo coach. What is the role of an inter-county coach these days? I suppose, especially in a county like Carlo. I mean, I read before you said you're basically working with two hands tied behind your back financially.
Yeah, Michael, I would say my experience is probably a lot different to other coaches. And you know, Turlick would tell you that as well. I was very hands-on in the point of view was that I was literally doing everything from the football perspective, all the coaching. You know, I was doing it. Now, don't get me wrong, with John Farrell on board with the video analysis, John's brilliant. John actually worked with, he was actually the video analysis on Georgian rugby. He was living in Georgia for a while, but he was doing our stuff, you know, obviously via the computer and stuff, and he would have the stuff fired in and analysed top class. He's actually a brilliant analysis. But I would actually would have dissected the video myself. I like to do that anyway, and would have presented it to the group as a whole, you know, and maybe 15, 20 minutes after training or whatever. But listen, we were restricted in what we could do from the financial side of things, because wouldn't it be beautiful to have, you know, access to 30 GPSs where you could track training and monitor training and, you know, see who's moving well and who's not, and to compare. For example, you know, take games. I knew, for example, in Division 3, we played Westmeath, and we played, who was it, Sligo and Westmeath, the first two games. And the performance levels were sort of where we wanted them to be. Then Longford were coming to town in the third game, and Carlow were actually sitting top of the division at the time. And all the talk in the papers all week was about Longford are missing 14 players, and missing the mother lock of the players, and the five boys have left the panel, and different things they got, and stuff like that, you know. And it was 5-5 in the stroke, 5-4 in the stroke at half time, and Daniel St. Ledger hit the post with a penalty, and they came up the field and equalised. And in the second half, they got a scrambly goal, and they ended up winning big three or whatever. But when I watched the video back, lads, I could clearly see from the naked eye that our intensity wasn't there. Niall Cullen was actually refereeing the game for Fermanagh, and I didn't get a chance to speak to him after the match. And I went into the referee's room after, just to knock the door and say, "Niall, well done." And he says, "Jesus, Stevie," he says, you weren't your normal sales today." Now, like, if you're wearing a GPS tracker, you can see where people's workloads are. You can see, you know, the distance I've covered, sprint distance I've covered. I would bet your bottom dollar that if we had looked at the stats in the first two league games in comparison to the third league game, we wouldn't have been at where we wouldn't have been at the levels that we would have wanted to, Michael. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know, so just I know I'm only talking about GPS here. It's a small thing, but it's the small things that make the big things happen. The more small things you have right, the bigger things happen, you know. And even take, for example, a training weekend. We would have got away to the Johnson House quite a bit for one night. Now, you're talking about one night, so you wouldn't have been arriving until, say, midday, 1-2 o'clock on the Saturday, and you would have to leave at 11 on the Sunday. But the work that we packed in, and you're talking about cohesion and spirit, you know, you're eating together, the boys are sleeping together, they're eating breakfast together, they're training together, you're all there in the pool together. That's huge. Dublin are doing that maybe for 5 nights. You know, like, I remember a couple of years ago chatting to someone who said that I think they were in the Carlton House over the bank holiday weekend from Thursday to Monday. Can you imagine the work you would get done in a camp like that? Now, imagine the money it would cost too. But you imagine that the work that you would get done. And I just think there needs to be a more of a levelling out of the financial spread, particularly among the smaller counties. And I think, like you asked me the question, John, about the game, I think that will help the game. You know, that if smaller counties are helped financially, I'll give you an example, lads. And this is an interesting one for you. We had 11 or 12 lads based in Dublin. So rather than drag them down the road 4 nights a week for their two pitch sessions and their two S&C sessions, we said to the Dublin-based players, do your S&C in Dublin. So Turner contacted Crow Park and asked about the availability for the Abbottstown. Okay. So the lads went over to Abbottstown on the Tuesday night, done the weights, perfect, great setup. I texted a few of the boys, unbelievable, Stevie, we're buzzing. Back the following week, and the equipment was taken out of Abbottstown because Dublin GA owned the equipment. So when the lads arrived, there was no equipment for them, no nothing. Doors were more or less padlocked at the door. Fuck you, you're not training. This is ours. You know, so, like, what do you do? You know, you are restricted in what you can do. So do you ask 12 lads from Dublin to cart themselves down the road again, stuck in traffic, and go back up the road again and then put an extra expense on the county board to cover those lads' travel expenses? Because the majority of them are students. You know what I mean? So it is very, very difficult. And I think, Michael, that's what separates the top pack from the rest. I don't necessarily think that it's coaching or, you know, the actual capabilities of the player. It's the athleticism and the shape and the condition that they're in. And that comes through proper S&C. Not saying that, geez, we had brilliant S&C, but collective. What I mean is proper collective S&C, monitored, individual programs tailored, just little extra expense, plus their nutrition. The nutrition, like, those guys aren't getting chicken curry after training once a week or twice a week. Those boys are getting their meals delivered 3-4 days in advance, you know, well looked after. I know for a fact, because I met Johnny Cooper at a coaching, I was asked to do a coaching conference down in Skerries one Easter, and he was asked down as well. I've seen the stuff he was eating and stuff that he's pulling out of little lunch boxes and stuff like that. And look, he's not sitting up to 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock on a Monday night prepping up for Tuesday. you know, that's all hand delivered for them, you know.
So what can the GAA do in that situation, maybe for counties like Carlow and the smaller counties, to help them more? Is it to fight just finances essentially?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and I think as well, a lot of other counties can. For me, Michael, I think, you know, we really did get the most out of the group that we had. You know, we maximised, we did our best in what we could do, you know, and we didn't sort of cry and moan about it. You know, we got on with it, you know, and we made ourselves very competitive. That's the very first thing. And we got a lot of criticism for that. You know, like, we had to set up in a particular way to make ourselves. The first thing we were going to do, the first thing we decided to do, Michael, was very straightforward. After finishing bottom of Division 4 in Turlough's first year and having been beat by 38 points in the senior championship in Leinster, you had to do something. So the first thing was, lads, we need to compete. So all we wanted to do was fucking compete, make ourselves really difficult to beat, you know, make it hard, make teams earn a win against us, you know, and have a system, have a set system where players know, right, we've got a template and we can move from this, you know. And we were developing it. What happened was in 2017, we were putting the foundation in. In 2018, we blew off the scales. Like, we had plus 37 score difference in the National League. We put 436 past Louth and Kildare in the championship. There was nothing wrong with our game in 2018. But in 2019, what happened was we lost a player who had scored 373 in the championship the year before, Paul Roderick. So when you take 373 out of any fucking team, you know, yeah, you take Monaghan, Manus out of Monaghan. You know, you take, well, I don't even want to compare Dublin because they could just replace like with like. But if you take a McManus out of Monaghan, or take a back in his heyday, take a Matty Ford out of Wexford, or, you know what I mean? You know, you're taking the marquee player who is, you know, look at how Tipperary have struggled this year without Quinn Living. Do you know what I mean? You know, so you're taking your primary scoring threat out and putting that weight onto maybe another player. So the opposition, for example, might target the likes of a Broderick and say, right, we'll put our best man marker in him and we'll maybe crowd a bit of space in front of him. But then that frees up a Dara Foley or a Brendan Murphy or someone else to step up. But then when you take him out and then they can spread their resources a bit more, then it obviously makes it easier for them then to combat you. But for a county like Carlow, that's small, like, let's be honest, second smallest county in Ireland, you can't afford to lose a man of that calibre. So I don't think there was anything wrong with how we were progressing. Like, we were averaging I think we averaged about 115, 213 in 2018. And in 2019, that dropped to about 112-ish. And the reason for that was 111, 112-ish was that man himself. You know, 6 or 7 points a game, guaranteed. You know?
And how did the Carlow project come along, Stevie? Like, are you the type of guy to kind of, like, would you jump at a kind of project like Carlow, or, like, were you excited by it?
Well, it's a strange one because I'm actually not trying to, at the tail end of 2015, in Clubmans in Kilkenny, my former school. I run a coaching clinic every year, lads, in around November. And last year, actually, in Newry, we had 350 coaches from all over Ireland came to it, you know, and not bad for a wee event that started in about 11 years ago and more in a small PE office. But Turlough and Tommy landed down it, and, you know, you create a great network and a great bond with other coaches, you know, throughout these days. And we exchanged emails and we chatted a bit. And what more or less happened was, John, Turlough asked me down in 2016 to take a couple of sessions, just guest sessions. So myself and the wife landed down at Carlow, first time in Carlow, bank holiday weekend in May 2016. And I have to be honest with you, very, very impressed with the quality that was in the group. So they lost the first round to Louth. They won the first round of the qualifier against Wicklow. And then they give Cavan a belly full of it in Breffy, and really, really were competitive in 2016.
Oh, I remember that game against Cavan, yeah.
And listen, I had only taken 3 or 4 sessions, but I was obviously, I was approached that year actually to manage down under 21s. And I went to meet the county board in October at that time, and it didn't work out for us. Self and Benny Coulter were taking the job along with Francie Pullman and John Kennedy. And we were stitched up a wee bit. So I was coming out of it really, really angry. And I'd done 10 years with Down. I'd done 3 years with under 21s, and I'd done 6 or 7 years with every age group in the development squads. And Turlough said to me, why don't you come down the road to us, give it a go, maybe once a week. You know, try once a week in November. So I went down every Sunday in November, enjoyed it. And I went down twice a week in December. And then in January, then we sort of went full-time in 2017. And listen, we had a bogey start. 2017, we drew away to Westmeath in the first game, and lads were probably getting carried away thinking, this is it. Second game in London, we were beaten. It was humiliation. You know, the chase room was toxic. And I was thinking, what the fuck have I got myself involved in here? You know, this is madness. But We then went on a great run. We won four of our last five National League games, missed out in promotion by a point. And then we beat Wexford in the Championship comfortably. Good, real, honest, credible performance against Dublin. You know, then we beat Leitrim, we beat London, and then we were so close to beating Monaghan. And we stretched our Championship run, lads, into the middle of July in 2017. So that gave you a great lift getting into 2018 then to progress and build. And so we stormed out of the league in 2018 comfortably and had two great Championship wins over Louth and Kildare, and you know, just unfortunately fell short in the Leinster final by a score or two. But it was, I don't think, lads, people appreciate where Carlo were when they first went to where they went, you know. But it was something that I really enjoyed, John. You know, my greatest weakness is probably one of my greatest strengths. My dad always says, you're nearly too loyal to a group. So, like I stayed with Ballyhoe for six seasons, you know, because I loved them. They're great lads. It created a great mentality, you know, bond with them. And the same in Carlo, you know, it was very hard to walk away from it when you were doing so well and you created such a great, you know, connection with a group of guys. Because I never genuinely thought, I mean this, I'm not the sort of guy, like, I know there's a lot of coaches out there that have coached 9 or 10 different counties and stuff like that there and have been on the conveyor belt for a while. I'm not the sort of coach that's really mad after that, you know, and I didn't feel that I would ever feel passion for another county like I have felt for my own, and something connected with Carlo, you know, and maybe it was a wee bit of a fairy tale story of us, you know, rags to riches type thing coming from nowhere and, you know, rattling the big boys or whatever, such a mean, but listen, we had a great wee journey and it was thoroughly enjoyable. And listen, struck up some great friendships from it as well. And go and play golf with the lads there regularly and stuff like that as well. I'm going down in a few weeks to see Turlock again, and we're going to go for a bit of a spin along the barrow and the bikes and stuff like that. You know, so like it's great to have those connections. You sort of made some real good solid relationships and friends for life, John. You know.
Yeah, and were they a good bunch to work with? Like you hear this crack of the Carlo rising. Like were they good? Was the camaraderie good, Stevie?
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And listen, you know, we created a culture within the group. It probably took us a good year. Like, but you know, we harnessed that, and you know, you could see that spirit developing within them. And some of them would have described the spirit as being the best. Like some of those lads have been there 12 years. Don't forget, and some of them would have described it as being the best spirit they've ever had within the senior group. You know, because what you're trying to do, lads, county level is different to club level. Club's different because club's very unique. You know, everybody's there. Everybody lives in the same community.
Yeah.
The club, the parish, the community. You know, it's very, very easy to identify that. But when you're pulling people from all communities who represent the county, you're trying to create a club atmosphere in the county engagement. And that can be very difficult because you're dealing with players who have maybe had smoke blown up their asses all their lives, who have been the star men in their club teams, who maybe have some egos, who maybe have an opinion about themselves. But I try to treat everyone very, very similar. And I suppose one of my strengths is my personality, my judgment of character, you know, my man management skills. And you can read the situation. If some lad needs a hug, some lad needs to go for a coffee, some lad needs a bit of hardball, some lad needs to eat pint, whatever, bit of social time, call around to the house, anything at all. You have to gauge the situation, you know, and that just probably comes, John, from experience. But yeah, they're a great bunch.
Mm-hmm. Seemed like it.
Steve, you mentioned obviously that Kildare game. Obviously, over the years, you played Dublin, Kildare, and you played quite well against these teams. Each team that you play, do you kind of set up in a different way, or do you kind of keep the same system going out through each game you play?
Yeah, there's no doubts. Listen, you'll have a platform, okay? You'll have a general platform in how you're going to approach most games, but there'll be certain games that will be tailored to meet the different situations. For example, take Dublin, okay? I don't think anyone can prepare for Dublin because it's just something else, you know. It's a steam train, like, you know, it's a runaway steam train that's coming at you from everywhere. So what we actually did in the lead up to the Dublin game was a bit mad. We broke our defensive zone into five zones. So we had zone one, which was, if you can imagine Croke Park, it's easier to explain to you. We had zone one, which was maybe 15 yards in from the Cusick. We had zone two, which was 15 yards this side of the D. Zone three was obviously the hot zone, the middle of the D, with zone four just to the right of the D, and then zone five just below the Hogan, you know, 15 yards in. So zone one and five, dead zones. Don't venture out there. If they want to venture out there, let them. And if they score points from out there, they're worldies. They're 1-5, you know. So and Dublin don't take pot shots anyway. So let them stay out there. So we concentrated on zones 2, 3, and 4. So what we did, lads, was we did an enormous amount of work in training off. We invited some of our best county minors and county under 20s in, and you're going to laugh at this, but we actually played the starting team that would be playing in Dublin for about 2 weeks, and we played 20 players against them in training. So the B team are the probables in training against the possibles, and the possibles had maybe 20 men, and there was 5 extra men everywhere, and I would give them certain specifics. I would say, right, sneak down that side, go round the back and see what way they react. And if you actually watch back the game, I watched it back a few times, like, tactically and defensively, it was fucking glorious. Like, we restricted Dublin to 8 scores in the first half. We had 57% possession of the ball. Like, no one has had that against them, you know. And you actually look back at it now and you think to yourself, we didn't get enough credit for it. Now, what happened was after 40, 42 minutes, it was 9-6, and Damer pushed the linesman. And if he had got the line, then, because they were rattled. They were rattled. Sherlock was out of his technical area. Gavin was out of his seat for the first time. They were probably rattling, lads. They were always going to win the game. I'm not trying to take away, but they were always going to find a way to win it, right? But I don't think they expected us to be in the game after 40 minutes, you know, a one-score game. And what happened was, when he pushed the line, when he got sent off, I really do feel that we would have stayed in that game right to the end. Not 2-3 points, but maybe 3-5 points we would have stayed in. They never had a single shot in the goal, lads, the whole game. But what happened was, 2 minutes later, Brendan got sent off, and he was our primary outlet on kickouts and things like that as well. And then they obviously went out and beat us then, or whatever it was, 18-7 or whatever it happened to be. But, like, looking back on it now, you know, for that first 40 minutes, lads, it was absolutely perfect. You know, and there's a lot of teams, lads, in Division 1 that have been blown away after 20 minutes, you know, and have been out of the game. So we stayed in the game for as long as we could, and we believed we could. And I'm going to give you an example, Michael, on top of that. So a part of our game plan against Dublin was the game management. So what we did is we did a lot of work on time wasting. And that might sound, fuck, that's a bit, you know, a bit cynical. But Dublin won a game to flow 100 mile an hour. So why get your kickouts? Why would you be getting your kickouts away in 6 seconds when they want that high intensity, high octane game? You know, that high octane game, high intensity game that they play. You know, at the end of the day, we can't play that because we don't have the athleticism that they have. But, like, there's other counties. I watched Roscommon playing them in the lead-up to our game. I think it might have been, a National League game. So Roscommon were 12 points down, and the goalkeeper was sprinting to get another ball, sprinting out, taking the short kick, and getting turned over and getting popped over the bar. And I was going, why didn't you just kill it for a minute and a half? Give your lads a bloody breather. So we actually killed the game, frustrated the game. We kept the ball for long periods of time. That was our game plan. You know, and when I seen the statistics in Sky Sports that we had 57% possession, it was textbook. The boys followed the plan and the letter of the law. And Paul missed a couple of handy frees in the first half. And I'm going to be honest with you, and I don't care, Sean Hurston that day gave Dublin the softest touch of free kicks. It was unbelievable. I mean that genuinely. There was literally no contact. And it was free. And if you actually look back through their score count, the amount of soft frees that they got that day was unbelievable, you know. But it was very, very pleasing. And it gave the lads great confidence. But then go to the Kildare game a year later, Michael. You talk about how you had different approaches. We knew we could get at them because we knew mentally that they were a little bit soft, okay? So we knew we could get at them sort of mentally as much as physically as well. So we brought a real physicality. And when we heard Cormac Riley was refereeing the game, we were delighted because Cormac has a very, very unique style that he doesn't blow little, small technical fouls. He referees the game the way it should be refereed, you know, letting it go. And then if it needs to be, there will be a free. So we knew we had him. We knew we could bring that little bit of added edge, you know, physically. Mm-hmm. And Cornwall were a big, strong team. But we didn't want to get caught with their kickouts. So what we did against Kildare, we didn't press any of their kickouts. We dropped off to the 45 and we pressed them from the 45 because when we watched them against Tyrone, I had rang the likes of Malachy Rourke and Tally and stuff before the game and said, look, what about this Kildare team? Tally had said to me, watch them against Tyrone because that's them at their best. When I watched them against Tyrone went full press and they were a big, what do you call it, a big man middle of the field for him, big Feely, isn't it? He was causing havoc. So they were going over the top. He was catching it, laying it off the runners. And they were actually creating goal chances. So we wanted to negate that, Michael, to take that out of the game. So by dropping off to the 45, the keeper's naturally just going to give it to the cornerback. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. We were literally handling in possession on the kickouts. But listen here, that was a different approach. And then, for example, against Louth, we knew we could get at the goalkeeper. So we went full press against him on every kicker. Do you know what I mean? You know, so yeah. You take a different approach. Every game carries a different approach. You know, for me, you always look at yourself. What are your strengths? Focus the majority of your time on them, Michael. Then look at the opposition and what are they going to bring and how can we negate their best influence, you know, and then you obviously try and get the balance right. That's the important thing.
You just mentioned something there, actually, I wasn't going to ask you about, but I will, because we had Emma Bolton on the other day, and he was talking about the Kildare team as well over the last few years being very mentally soft. But as a coach, how would you approach a team like that who are maybe quite soft mentally? How do you kind of give them a harder edge?
Well, it's difficult because I don't know the historical, I don't know the historical background to it, but, you know, living in Down and obviously having, you know, listened to Down people in the past, so Down people would carry, we would carry a great belief, you know, in fact, Down would believe that they'd win the All-Ireland every year, and they probably believe they could win it again this year. That's not, I know that sounds mad, but that's the truth. Like, you know, they just, they would feel we could come from nowhere and you wouldn't know what could happen. And I think it's a fantastic attitude to have, of course, you know, but it's a very positive self-image that they have, and that probably comes from history and tradition and things they got in the past. Like, but there's always been an association here with Kildare being a little bit fragile, you know, when things get really, really tough. And that's what I actually, we're going to take the credit for them beating Mayo, because I think after that game, they were humiliated. You know, they were actually humiliated to the extent that I felt and thought, we need to stand up for ourselves here, lads. And yeah. in simplistic terms, they grew a set of balls after that, you know, and they started to rough people up. They started to get into people's faces, stuff that they hadn't been doing. Like, wee Owen O'Connor was playing corner forward, like, and he missed a penalty and a free kick in the first 10 minutes. And I just jogged across the field and said, our cornerback, he's gone. He is gone. 15 minutes after that, he was whipped off. 15 minutes later, like, mentally, he was gone. Body language. I'm a big believer, Michael, in positive body language. If you produce a positive body language, chest out, shoulders back, you watch The Last Dance, Michael Jordan, and you watch that, like, great insight into the mentality, you know, where he's getting trash talked on the court and stuff like that, and he's giving as good as he gets back, but he stays, he stands up, he never wilts, he never goes into a shell, you know, he always stood up. And I think positive self-image displays an awful lot. Think back in the Guinness's book where Donegal made the breakthrough in 2011. They couldn't get round Tyrone. You know, this psychological edge Tyrone had. Donegal are saft. They're fucking saft. They were beat out the gate last year by Armagh in Cross McLean by 15 points. McGuinness was drumming that into them all the time. The perception of you in this country is that you are saft. That's the perception, you know. And all of a sudden, players start thinking, I'm going to prove him wrong, you know. And I think it has to come from within, obviously. But there's a number of ways to harness it. And I think that positive self-body image. So one of the things that McGuinness done that year was, instead of going down the line of, when McManaman slags your mother, you slag his sister. Instead of doing that, what they decided to do was praise each other. So when McBrady got a score, McFadden would run past him and say, nobody's stopping you today, Patrick. You're on fire. You know, and this, all of a sudden, Tyrone were going, fuck, are these boys going with this? You know, and that's true, you know. And I think when you get that and that energy, like Carlo that day, like, I gotta be honest, we peaked. But it wasn't just a peak. I watched that game and it made the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you listen to the atmosphere in the crowd. But our players on the field responded to that. Daniel St. Ledger turned Daniel Flynn over in the first 10 minutes, turned him over, and you can actually see the veins in his neck, grabs Flynn and fucks him to the ground after he lays the ball off, you know. And I just thought, look at that desire, that intensity. And our boys had that chest out, shoulders back, and it started before the throw-in where we sort of said, right, we stayed in our huddle, let them break out, and as soon as they broke out, we went up the field and there's a wee bit of a, you know, three shoulders, a wee bit of set to yourself. You know, we're not going to be bullied today. You know, we might be Division 4, but we're not going to be bullied. And I think that you have to display that side sometimes, Michael. You know, you have to be strong. You have to stand up for yourself. You know, you have to be brave. And you know, it's not about being brave and going for the ball. It's actually being brave and wanting to be on the ball. You know, people think braveness is going in for a 30-70 tackle. Braveness is actually when things aren't going well for you at corner forward, come out, get on the ball again. You know, don't hide in there and just think it's going to happen. Get out and get on the ball. Make something happen. You know, and I think that that's vitally important. Like, but listen, I think Kildare are absolutely brilliant footballers. I think they've got some of the best players in the country, you know, but sometimes you can listen to things and, you know, I think the media have created this bubble around Dublin that they are completely untouchable. Leinster's dead. It's finished. And that can get into a player's psyche too. Like, if you keep telling yourself that, you'll start to fucking believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if you keep telling me here now in this Zoom, like, Stevie, you are a great-looking fella, I'm actually going to start believing that.
You know, you are a great-looking fella.
I know. I'm very lucky. She's very lucky downstairs. But you know what I mean? You know, it's an interesting one. It really is, you know.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And Stevie, we were touching on the Dubs and bits and pieces. Like, say the week leading up to them, a game like that, Like, would that be probably some of your proudest kind of coaching moments? Like that's massive teams come up against. Like,
oh, John, we were so lucky. Like, the way it fell for us, like, you know, we played in 2018, we had played three of the All-Ireland semi-finalists. Like, that's, you know, we had some fantastic, and listen, don't get me wrong, we played some brilliant challenge games too. Like, we played the likes of us Common in challenge games, and we went down to Garvahy and played Tyrone twice that year, actually, played a bit of a challenge game. Feisty enough, we night there was about 5 cent off, I think, in the bloody challenge game. There was a carnage, it was behind closed doors, thank God. But no, but the thing about it is, like, you know, coming up with those things were fantastic, but they're fantastic for the county too, because it created a great buzz about the county, you know. That's why you don't want to take those days away. You need those days, and even though you might win 1 out of 100, it's that those days do absolute, it's unfounded what those days do for further on down the food chain, lads, you know, for the young age groups and stuff like that. But go back to your question, John, excuse me, about the lead up to the game. The lead up to the game, unbelievable buzz. You go to training on a Tuesday night and you see the Sky TV camera setting up at Dr. Cullen Park and they build up those games, you know, and the Thursday night you come to training, you know, you're 2 nights away and the sun's shining and the grass is cut and you're thinking of a full stand rocking in Cullen Park. You know, they're fantastic and they're great occasions. And yet, listen, lads, you know, I grew as a coach throughout my time too as well down there, you know, and I got a great experience. You know, they pit your wits against these guys. They study hours and hours of video of, you know, Kildare, they study hours and hours of video of Dublin and Road and Nottingham. And listen, they study hours and hours of video of your Offalys and your Wicklows and your Wexfords. You learn a lot more about the game. You get a lot more knowledgeable about the game. You get a lot more knowledgeable about certain players. Like, take, for example, Longford. You know, I think Mickey Quinn is an unbelievable footballer, right? A brilliant footballer. But like, he probably doesn't get the recognition for being that good a footballer because Longford don't get the same exposure that other counties get, you know. And going down to that level and working and being in Leinster, away from Ulster and away from the sort of real, you know, a traditional grind of Ulster football was actually really refreshing, John. Really refreshing, you know.
And say, like, what was like the shared line with Jim Gavin? Because like, I always watch when Dublin come out like to start a game. It's so professional, like a couple of cones, and it's just so, like, what's it like to share the line with that kind of setup?
Well, I had to tell him I'd see him after the game, because he came down to me and he said, "Stevie, you don't mind if you sign my baseball cap for me?" And I said, he was trying to distract me before the game. No, listen, Jim's a very quiet guy, but listen, be under no illusions, they're every trick in the book too, John. Like, you know, Charlotte's no angel when it comes to dragging his arse off the field and filling up pockets of space for goalkeepers to be kicking the ball into, and obviously the doctor and the physio working in tandem, they might as well have a rope tied around their waist 3 yards apart, because the two of them run across the field in tandem, you know, and Sherlock in front of them is like a relay race. But no, but listen, they're very, very well coached. And funny, I heard a brilliant one last week, lads. Oh geez, I can't remember his bloody name. This guy Wayne, it'll come back to me. But he was a trainer of the special forces in England, right? And he was that good at what he'd done. He went to America and he was like, he owns his own leadership company now. And he was telling a story about a mission that went on in Afghanistan. And he said, the reason this guy was renowned around the world for his missions being so well prepared, everything, you know, all the I's dotted, all the T's crossed, and preparation at a different level. Never had a failed mission in his life, never had a single casualty, you know, whatever. Anyway, he told this story that he prepared for this mission in Afghanistan, was going to be a really high-risk mission. And the whole thing's given. And he talked about the reason my team was the best team was because we'd done the basics better than everyone else. And Jim Gavin was a great advocate for hammering the basics. And the amount of interviews he would have come on to and said after the match, you know, our levels of skill acquisition there today weren't at the levels it should be at. And people going, oh, Jim's not giving much away. But it was the standards that he was setting for that group. And if there was 10 misplaced passes or there was 5 passes that went astray, that was too much for them. And he was a stickler for the basics. And I think that comes from his military background. You know, the aircraft, obviously, was he RAF or something? I don't know what he was, but the military aircraft or whatever that he would have flown. And I think that comes from that belt and braces mindset that he would have had. And I go back to the guy Wayne, where he talked about he suffered his first casualty in that mission, and it was one of his best friends, and his friend got shot and was killed in active duty. And he said, I never responded to it. He says, because what I had to think about was, right, Wayne, you deal with things that you can control, forget about things you can't control. So he couldn't control that moment, So that moment for him was dead. Now, that's a real ruthless, cold environment and not something that I would enjoy. But it shows you that you can actually link it into football as well. An incident happens. And this is a weakness of mine too, lads. I get myself emotionally wrapped up in the game. I'm not afraid to say that. You know, it's hard to see stuff. Sometimes a decision goes against you. And I find that hard to leave. I concentrate on that for like 15 seconds. You know, can't fucking believe he's given that against us. You know, and when in retrospect, forget about that and move on. You know, it's the next ball. It's the next phase. That's the most important thing. And I have learned over the last few years to start thinking like that. I've now started to say to the people that I work with and coach, look, focus on the next play. Forget about that. Focus on the next play. That's all we can control now, you know. And it's something that obviously Galvin is very much in control. But John, beyond our illusions, let's be fucking honest. You know, we'd all look in control if we were winning games on an average by 15 points. You know, we would all look very much in control. So it's very easy to look in control. I go back to 2013 when he sat on the bench and he was 9-3 up against Donegal and he was laughing and joking with his selectors and it was caught on camera. And Donegal then ended up catching them that day and scoring 3 goals. And that was the last time Dublin conceded 3 goals in a championship match 7 years ago. Yeah. Phenomenal. Phenomenal statistic. But he learned an awful lot that day, I think. I think he learned some hard lessons. I think he learned lessons not to show much emotion. That's probably why he's so placid, so bland, so straight-faced. Because that day they were giggling and laughing. And in McGuinness's book, he talks about it. He says he glanced up through the big screen and noticed them all sort of sitting in the dugout laughing. And at half-time, he made reference to it to the Donegal players. And Donegal went out in the second half and blew them out of the water. Absolutely blew them out of the water. That's for 3-14. I think it was the highest championship scoring that Dublin have conceded. I could be wrong, but I think it was, you know. Because if you think about it, I said this a couple of years ago when I was asked how to beat them, you know, or have Mayo any chance of beating them or Throne any chance of beating them. And I said, like, you probably do need to score 3 goals. You probably need to replicate what Donegal done. You probably need a 3-14, a 3-15 to beat them. That's the reality, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to do now as well, isn't it? They've kind of got tighter in defence and stuff. Sorry, so Tyrlach O'Brien resigned yesterday, Stevie. Were you surprised by the news?
Listen, I had a feeling it was coming, lads. You know, listen, myself and Tyrlach would still be very close. We'd still chat regularly. You know, we would probably chat every week at least once or every couple of weeks anyway. And we'd WhatsApp each other quite a bit. Like he's become a very good close friend of mine, lads. And, you know, obviously the reasons are obviously personal to him, but I can understand his thinking behind it. You know, he was never going to stay this year anyway. So what are we on now? I'm looking at the date here, 7th of June. So Carlo might have actually been heading into the championship, you know, in the next few weeks, and that was going to be him done anyway. So he's probably looked at, he was waiting for the GAA roadmap to come out. And I think if the GAA had have sort of said that the county football would kick off at the end of June, he probably would have hung about for it, lads, you know. But the fact that it's not kicking off till October, if it does kick off at all, he's probably thinking another long winter. You know, he's not getting any younger and he likes his cycling and he likes his life. And, you know, he's probably thinking himself, do I need the hassle of rolling in? But Tyrlach's a very unselfish guy and he would always put the best interests of Carlo first. And I can see his thinking. And it's interesting. And I wonder will other managers think the same? Because what he's thinking is, I'm going to be finished in November. And it's going to give a new manager less than 4 weeks, really, to prepare for a National League, because players are obviously going to need a bit of a break for a few weeks, and then you're into December. And then you've only 4 or 5 weeks to prepare for 2021. So he's probably thinking, I agree with what he's doing, you know. I think he's given them a bit of time now, but the problem is getting someone now, because most people are in jobs, you know.
Yeah. And tell us about your relationship with Tyrlach. I mean, the 2 years when you're on the line for Carlo.
Well, we shared a bed in London, lads.
Lovely.
No, I done some laughing. We landed in the London boy in the hotel room, and it was big, you know, those big king size beds. And I says, O'Brien, I'm not fucking sleeping beside you. So obviously, you may ring the reception and get a camp bed up here. We had some great days, and you know, I was chatting to Carlo Kane from the Irish Star earlier on, and I was laughing. I found a wee video on my phone the other night. He came down to Newry last summer and he actually stole a fucking plant out of my mother's garden. My mother gave him a beautiful big plant he's wild in the flowers and the garden he has at home's class. So, but the sort of caliber of the lad, boys, you know, the night that Carlo got promoted, we were in Antrim and we stopped in Newry, ironically, my hometown, and we had our meal in the canal court. So a few pints were had and my family joined us and Marie was there, the wife and stuff, and our girls. It was nice that happened in Newry, you know, so close to my own heart. And the boy says, you're coming down the road to Carlo with us tonight on the bus. And I was going, lads, I'm schooling Tuesday, because it was St. Patrick's weekend. So I was off the following day Actually, lads, I have school Tuesday. I can't go down the road tonight. And they're, no, you're coming down. And I looked at Marie and I said, and you're coming too. So I think Broderick or something said, look, the two of you can stay in our house. So we're like, right. And so, fucking, we'll go down. So we'll worry about getting home on Monday, you know. So we went down the road. And lads, this is a true story. The Carlo team bus with the fucking big crest on the side of it drove up into our small cul-de-sac here in Newry, reversed down into the cul-de-sac. You can see the neighbours peeping out of the blinds going, what the fuck's going on here? This Carlo bus. And Marie jumped off the bus, got an overnight bag, and away we went. And it was the best bus journey I was ever on in my life. 2 hours. We stopped at an off license actually down in the Belfast Road, my local shop. And the woman was like, whoa, you're busy tonight. I said, look, we're just going to lift everything out of this fridge here. So the lad cleared the off license. There was champagne, there was beer, there was everything. But anyway, put a long story short, we woke up a bit hazy the next day, and Broderick made us a bit of breakfast or whatever, and me and her were like, how the fuck are we getting home? And like, they were all going for a spell over there too, so none of them were driving us home. So I said, look, there's a train at 2 o'clock, we'll go from Carlo and the train to Dublin, change at Dublin and back down the road then. So my mum and dad had the two girls, and needless to say, anyway, we went down to the local pub in Carlo for a bit of a cure. And the next thing you know, Brian lands in and he says, mum, and I said, where are you going? He goes, I'm leaving you up to the train station. I said, right. So we drove past the train station. I said, where are you going? He goes, I can leave us to Dublin. By the time we got to Dublin, Michael, he drove us to fucking Newry. You know, he's such a man. You know, yeah. That was, I know that mightn't think like a big thing, like, but just think for us, you know, for him to take 6 hours out of his day, drive us, you know, fucking 250 miles home. And he, the laugh was, I rang him on the way back to thank him, and he answered his phone at Kilcullen, and the fucking guards pulled him in and fined him 50 fucking euros. So he says, it cost me a fortune, poaching your bollocks here. But Marie organised a surprise 40th birthday for me last year in Newry, and I knew very little about it. And we were out for a meal, and I landed into the local GA club in Newry, and Daniel St. Ledger and Paul Broderick and Turlick and Tommy Hogan were there. And it just, very, very humbling, lads, you know, to see them lads. Like, I didn't expect any of them lads to even consider coming down the road, you know, but Marie invited quite a few of them down, you know, because she knew the connection and the respect and the you know, the affection that I would have had for them all as people. And it was great, you know, those small things, lads, you never forget, you know, you never forget those wee small things. And he's just a great man, great people's man, lads. Lovely way with people. Such a nice man, you know, very, very seldom curse. But I want to put one thing fucking on record. This is breaking news. We played Leash. And Turlick O'Brien had never, ever called a player a bad name in his life. And I mean in his life. And not Bollocks Parkinson, give me the blame for this. But Gary Walsh was playing. And Walsh was a bit of a header anyway. Good lad. Like, I met him a few times actually on nights out. He's a bit of a character. I actually think he's a good guy. Like, but he was playing, and he did something off the ball to one of our players. And Turlick went to sort of run down the line and tore his calf. But he was shouting, Walsh, hey Walsh, you knacker, you're a knacker. And he sort of said to me after, I regret it. And then the next thing you know, 2 days later, Parkinson has it on Twitter. The on boy from the north, boy, he's calling Leash players knackers. And I see what you've done to me. So we were both as bad for each other, you know. But no, listen, there were great days. There were great days. And, you know, he should be very, very proud, lads, of what he done for Carlo. And I don't even think what he done for Carlo GA. What he done for Carlo as a whole, because, you know, Carlo were crying out for a team to follow and a team to support. And I knew who the hardcore supporters were, and I got to meet them, you know, very, very quickly. And, you know, there's some great lads there, boy, who have followed that team through thick and thin, and men, ladies, you know, women, children, like, who have been there in the bad days, boy. And you would have looked at the stand against London in 2017 in the second National League game, lads, and you could have counted the people in the stand, you know, in 10 seconds. And the man and his dog, as you say, and then you go a year later and you're home to fucking meet them, you know, and the stand is buzzing on a Saturday night, packed to capacity, roaring atmosphere, you know, and that's the difference he made, you know, and the guys made as well, was bringing that buzz and that bit of crack back, you know, because, listen, people probably listen and think about Carlo and, you know, Dublin and Tyrone and Monaghan and Mayo and dismiss, you know, what it meant to them and how, but you had to be there, lads, to experience how low things were to how high they got, you know, and in such a short space of time, which then probably makes me believe it's probably possible in other places too, lads, you know.
Mm. Last one for me, Stevie, you've been great with your time. Current setup at the minute with Down, how are you finding that?
Really, but well, nothing for the last week, but no, really, really enjoyable. Very different, very, very different. You know, to jump in the car and we actually train in my school in St. Joseph's, you see. So Like training starts at 7:15. I leave the house at 6:45, you know, when you're there in 90 seconds. My school's only 90 seconds away, John. So that aspect of it is huge. It's your own county, which again is even more important, because not that my heart wasn't in Carlo, my heart is firmly in Carlo, but and will always be in Carlo, would be the first result to look for outside of Down. But you know, you're stenched and down, and you've worked with other lads, you've watched them in schools, football, and watched them and the likes of that. And obviously the opportunity to work with James as well. James is a brilliant manager. You know, he's obviously been the most successful Down manager since Pete McGrath. You know, in the last 25 years, James took us to an All-Ireland final, point away from winning All-Ireland, and had us competing in Division 1 on a regular basis. Like, so, and I'd be listening to some of the nuggets that he'd be giving the young lads. Like, say, for example, a young corner forward, he might be saying to him, I used to do this when I was playing, you know, use your arse and do this here, blah, blah, blah. And you'd be going, I'd love to be a young lad. Getting that sort of coaching advice and information of a man of that caliber, that sometimes young lads don't appreciate. That it's a hard generation to get through to the lads, you know, and I find it takes them a long while to get going in sessions. I kind of find it, you know, trying to make that connection with them is like, oh, yeah, because it's not minors anymore. It's actually 15 and 16 year olds, mm-hmm. because they've gone down to under 17. So you're having it done, you're coaching down. I remember the first few weeks, Mark Poland's doing a bit of the coaching. Myself and Mark are doing most of the coaching, and Daniel and James would do a fair bit of the managing side of things with the lads. But like, I would say, me and Paulie would be saying, Charlie, is it you? And he'd be going, oh, no. He says, is it just me? I'd be saying, and he'd be going, no, no, I fucking see it too. Like, it'd be driving me insane. I remember ringing Kieran McKeever one of the first few weeks. I was, because after coming lads from coaching senior club and senior county, you go back into that level, you know, of underage coaching, you know, on a full-time basis, because obviously I'm coaching underage in school, but the coach at the high-level underage, I rang McKeever, and he had been an Armagh minor manager for a few years. I said to him, tell me this, Kieran. I said, is it freaking, are these boys, and he goes, Stevie, he says, tear the script up. He says, start right back at the beginning and start at the basics and dumb the coaching right down. And it's something they've probably had to do, John. You know, I'm firing stuff at them that I might have fired at senior county players, and you just have to bring it right down, because they're only children. They're only children, you know, and that's the important thing. But we met up with them there last week on Zoom. And for the first time, it was good to see them all again, and they're all keeping well and keeping fit. And sure, young lads now, sure, all they need is that there mobile phone, and sure, they're laughing, you know what I mean? And then that keeps them entertained, most of them, during the day, I'd say. But it's been good, really enjoyable, and we have a good team this year, a really good team. So if there is a championship, you never know, we might be a kick in the arse somewhere.
So we want you to win the championship.
Absolutely. And if see if it goes well, lads. I told wee James this, right? If it goes well, I'm taking the credit. Steve, if it doesn't go well, I'm fucking him under the bus. And that's the truth.
Stevie, thanks very much. That was brilliant. Really appreciate that.
Not a bar, lads. Listen, Michael, John, it was great chatting to you, boy. Really enjoyed it, lads. Really enjoyed
Cheers.
It.
Thanks right, very much, Stevie.
Lads, Cheers, Stevie. Look after yourself.
You too, lads. Take care, boys. Look after yourselves. Launch it.
Thanks for listening in, and don't forget to follow the Mick and Max GA Football Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and we are on Spotify.